All right, we're live. Good afternoon, April 22nd, 2022. I'm like, April? Is it August? No, April. We are talking today. We're following up from a few days ago. We promised that we would continue on the subject of the Great Reset. And we had been talking about the Panopticon, the smart city. I want to welcome everybody, whether it's this morning for you or this afternoon or this evening. Somewhere, it is always sometime. Always remember that. The Great Reset first of all is a failing plan, as we have been discussing at length. And this is primarily a factor of timelines, and the fact that, or rather the conclusion, if we use our words carefully, the conclusion of looking at many observable phenomena is that the timelines involved dictate the success of things, because there are different moving technologies all emerging at the same time, while we are simultaneously having this great awakening, which also must continue to transform people. Imagine for a moment, if you will, if the radically liberatory concept of self-responsibility, that we are absolutely free to choose, to be driven by God, to be driven by a ceaseless search for truth, to present and to promote love into the world in every interaction that we have, every person that we meet, to try to treat them as if they know something that we don't. Because that will often be the case. And the foundation of this existence that we are in is love. Because love is both on the creating and receiving end of the process of free will. Like, people talk about problem, reaction, solution. And I say that it's love, freedom, love. There's nothing wrong with operating with other people in a common cause, where you have a shared sense of what the solutions have to be. And there may be all kinds of things that tie you together, be they sociopolitical, religious, familial, regional, by work, by industry, by occupation. There's all kinds of things that can unite and divide people and categorize and define people in this matrix. But there's nothing wrong in making common cause with people. But if the self-identity of a permanent victim is one which begins to define your identity, to be circular, then you will quickly find that this degenerates very quickly into increasing legitimization of violence, because the victim knows no bounds. The permanent perpetual victim has no limits to, you know, their distortion of what perpetual and permanent justice will look like. Every particular wrong has to be quantified in some way. And the response to that particular wrong has to be understood as the relationships between all of these abstract subjects in question have interacted upon with each other. And in just as in interpersonal relationships, when you're trying to build something in the future with somebody, and of course you have a past, there's always been times of asymmetry in the power dynamics of romantic relationships, right? And at different times, and sometimes it goes back and forth, sometimes you're more unequal, but we all fall into difficult times. And we can imagine those relationships between different groups of people in society, just in a very similar way. And whether they be religious, ethnic, so-called racial, whatever, national. So while it's important to list and address and acknowledge the history of many different problems that, you know, are part of our, you know, relationship to existence, and to solve those and to transcend them. But if you have no limitation or no definition of the specific things in it, and have just a concrete, realistic of things that could change or ought to change to redress that. In other words, if that grievance is used as the justification or pretext for a boundless and never-ending war, if it's limitless, if it drives an ideology where the only solution is the utter destruction of the other definition or other entity, then that is a problem. So this is the framework through which I look at. You can use that in either direction, incidentally. So when I look at in the conflict in Ukraine, to me, it's more evident that the I'm not on this point talking about the legitimacy of their invasion or incursion or a special operation. I'm just talking strictly on the subject of their treatment of the other side. Now, I don't have any illusions that they have their military police, and when they capture like high value people that aren't turning over information, that they don't, you know, apply pressure. You know, I'm not, you know what I'm saying? We can't be naive, right? But the basic treatment of the basic, you know, everyday person that they capture, that's there's no particular information of high security value that they may have beyond what rumors they've heard or what they saw. So, you know, it's just very different observable treatment when you take into consideration that. So there's a very high probability that the Ukrainian forces have captured 400, 500. Okay. Republican and Russian, I guess, combined. And when they stated that they wanted to trade and that they had whatever it was, 340, 370, and they had agreed on a one-to-one. But then later the Ukrainians came back and said that they only had like some 35 that they could present. And that to me was highly alarming. Now they could be just doing their stupid bad faith negotiating tactic of regressive bargaining, which is each time that you talk about the deal gets worse, right? So I think that realistically, just to kind of come back a little bit, the victim framework is a very big driver, and it is based on something real, right? But the response or sense of redressive, or however you would call it, justice, to redress the issues, the grievances, that there you could build just a normal consensus around, and you have some kind of social contract that's implicit through practice and acknowledged or understood or not. And not, you know, just however that works, as many complex ways, you know, to be like, there should be a law, you know, none of that. Just what is the vibe in the society and how do people really feel about things? And if you do you honestly represent or present to the world, whether people are honestly, you know, are people honestly racist, right? For example, and, you know, if you redefine that word, then you can probably pinch out a definition. I mean, you know, that says yes, right? But just in the conventional meaning of the word, you know, no, right? So, and we should be proud of this. We should be proud of the amount of racism that we've eradicated, institutional racism, and that people just aren't that racist is the thing. So it's given that, that this needed process of reform in society was, you know, generally peaceful, and where there was civil disobedience, it was organized and aimed towards very peaceful ends. And, you know, there was not a resisting of arrest. That was part of the deal of, you know, you take the hit, you know, that's what civil disobedience is. You sit down and you get arrested, you know, you do a sit in or whatever. And that's the propaganda of the deed, you know, as the anarchist would say, perhaps, But it's a good thing to do, right? And you have to be able to have media and things like this, you know, mobilized to record it, and otherwise it didn't happen, right? So the victim mentality then is massive. It's a massive aspect of moving various social movements, but that doesn't mean it's the only kind of thing that motivates bad people. I'm not simplifying, you know, all people with a victim mentality as being bad people or involved in any negative activities at all. Okay, there are people who see themselves as victims that are, you know, don't transform that into sort of like hard judgments on other people, right? But we're talking about the way that that dynamic or sort of that social, the social aspect of that psychology can kind of be multiplied out and used on people to, you know, redirect maybe real existing frustrations even, but take them towards like a crazy direction. That's how I look at it anyway. I mean, you know, it's, but what I'm saying is not sensational. You know what I'm saying? I'm not saying anything sensational. And I think that's, you know, maybe the dangerous thing is that when people really think about the solutions, the people at the top who are kind of like proposing the solutions to the way that they define the problem are kind of meant to like dehumanize us and make us surrender our basic sense of dignity or rights on some kind of new social historical definition of who gets to speak in society, you know, and or who can occupy space. And certainly if the removal and degradation of rights in the public sphere and private sphere, that was a real phenomenon in the United States towards all kinds of people of backgrounds. But in particular, there's a relationship with Black folks because of the legacy of chattel slavery. So, I mean, these people were enslaved. So they're descendants of enslaved people, you know, certainly have not in this very short period of time ago in the scheme of things, and not everything has been solved. But what has been solved is that people are not racist. See, like the definition, they're playing fast and loose with these words because the definition of institutional racism is that it's institutional. It doesn't mean that it's constitutional. It doesn't mean that it's a necessary aspect of the Constitution today because of the brilliant way that the Constitution was written. So the debate is not whether the Constitution contained or not aspects which legitimized slavery. The argument is whether what makes constitutional republics function, unlike France on its whatever number, the 25th republic or whatever the fuck they are, you know, the United States has a flexible constitution. But if the Constitution cannot be transformed in unconstitutional ways, correct? Those would be unconstitutional, right? But the mixture of outcomes of the whatever 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th amendments of the Constitution are I think you know, done a product of their own time, and there will be aspects of how those, you know, things have been interpreted in courts that will you know, stay with us for some time. But even though we talk about you know, we don't want judicial activism, at the same time, you know, there's a reason why we kind of have these like political litmus tests, right? If we're just being more clear with how we use the words, we still apply a political litmus test to people that we want to see like put on the Supreme Court, right? Which is not the same thing as maybe like the real issues, right? The real issues being more like what rationale do they use to come at those things that have certain political outcomes, right? You can, so even like, for example, well, just, you know, the public concern, and this is kind of how we're going to connect this to the Great Reset, okay? Because the Biden, the team Biden had proposed going into the Great Reset, team Biden had proposed that they would want to have some number. Let me know if it was 25 or 20, 22 or 28 Supreme Court justices. And then they also were talking about they want to change it from not being, change it from like the life appointment system that we have now and make it into not being that you're there forever. It's just that you term out or whatever. And then the next president can appoint more. And it's like it's like basically maybe in the deal, the Senate has greater powers to cross-examine and disapprove of them. But that's just like changes the Supreme Court, I think, in a very negative way when you think about it, right? Because the main idea is that these branches of government are separate. And the intention is that the way to interpret the structure of how the relationships between these three distinct areas of government are, then that necessitates an understanding that they're more supposed to be more equal than not. So consequently, moves, if it's an agreement between the executive and legislative branch to exert more control over the judiciary, that's just a power feedback loop that first of all compromises the nature of the Supreme Court, right? It degrades its own autonomous power significantly, that its members aren't there for life from their own as a power vector. They don't have legislative power and they don't have executive power. But now who's there? It's, you know, too many people. I mean, think about the quality of the Supreme Court justices would have to go down, because in theory, the ones that we have are the best that could or would be, right? And just because that's not the fact doesn't mean that you solve the problem by increasing the potential of a mismatch to actual ability to the market for ability, which is what, going to be 22, 25, 28 Supreme Court justices? That's insane, right? So the things that Team Biden had been introducing to do, however, included more. Okay, and now they have fomented this cult of the victim mentality, the victim ideology, right? But they themselves don't see themselves as victims. Like Biden, Team Biden, and the Klaus Schwab, okay? Maybe Harari sees himself as a victim, but, you know, Klaus Schwab and Biden and you know, Bill Gates, they don't see themselves as victims, just to understand. Okay, it's a way of seeing the victim way, the victimhood thing of seeing history through the lens of a perpetual victim class, and that you're a member of it, raises the the stakes that you're going to be drawn in, be able to be manipulated by a political ideology where the, you know, retribution in the pursuit of justice is perpetual, permanent, and necessarily far exceeds any harm that might be or cost or consequence that might be very minimal in reality necessary for parties to agree on a social contract, right? I mean, you don't just, the answer can't just be war and everyone has to die or become your slaves, right? Because the other case had been for so long or et cetera. That's a non-starter, right? That can't be. Just think about what we were talking about just at the top of the hour, that this is exactly what we mean when we talk about romantic relationships. Relationships driven where you know that, and really how these romantic relationships evolve in long-term relationships, marriages, right? So when you're solving problems, you don't make the whole long list of problems in the past and grievances that you had in the past, right? Because at each of those times in the past that you talked about and interacted with in the aftermath of that problem, when it was addressed, you should address these problems like individually, and the solutions have to be quantifiable, and then just like that, and then agreed. That's the point. No one is denying that in the United States there are many different types of injustices. Many different types of injustices. Anyone saying it's just race is playing a game of oppression Olympics. No one wins the oppression Olympics, you know? So it's just like that. So you can see in Ukraine how that's been used. Right. But also think about how people have seen this similarity between Greta Thunberg and Zelensky. These demands that they make, they're like the spoiled child that makes demands and stuff. It's crazy. How they flip the script is very abusive. It's very abusive. There are no two countries that are equal in power in the world, precisely. And Ukraine fell into a very bad situation that no one could help it, because its friends were not its friends. And it's just an awful and sad thing. And Ukraine, as a collective identity of a people, of a nation, wound up having the wrong friends. They were not, they didn't, it's just so crazy, because you know, there's like these two processes going on at the same time that are just so wild, where you had the Ukrainian expatriate community in Canada for a long time, and there's a lot of Holodomor mythology that was originated as Nazi propaganda, but through the internet, like in the very early 90s, like integrated like into libertarian views. There had been, though, in the U.S., a longer tradition on the so-called Christian, very far right, like the John Birch Society, that used to produce like extreme takes like on the origins of communism and stuff like that, that were just copy pasted from the Nazis. Now, look, if a Nazi says the sky is blue and the sky is blue, then, you know, maybe a Nazi can be right about the color of the sky or something like this. So certainly there are facts and moments of, you know, in the Soviet Union, lots of unnecessary arrest or a very strange non-adversarial approach to a justice system where you have to prove your innocence effectively. You know, this is not a system that is comfortable or necessary, let alone just or moral or ethical, in my view. But who am I, right? But I'm just trying to understand these processes. But I know that with the Ukrainian expatriate community really went and reinforced this victim mentality. And it had been going on for some time, but as to really become a developing mainstream view in modern Ukraine, kind of like was exemplified by, we talk about before, Kuchma, right? Kuchma's work. Ukraine is not Russia. What was it? So, in solving problems between people, you can't refer back to some escapade of 1709 or something. You have to look realistically at your balance of forces and power on the ground, how much control you can exert over it if you don't destroy your state, if you don't destroy your army on the rocks of the Russian army. Like, time to be realistic here, guys. Are you controlled by lunatics? But you're, you know, no. Yes, but they're not in control. It's the cabal. And, you know, they of course would like to frustrate and do something with Russia, but they can see that Russia will take this. At the same time, the cabal can always call it a victory for themselves too, no matter the outcome of this conflict in Ukraine. The cabal can be like, because in fact, it doesn't make sense actually once you understand it, but what they will claim, what the cabal will, you know, within how they will try to rationalize it. Because that's what they do. They go and they backfill the narrative of their activities, like every narcissist or psychopath does, to backfill the narrative so that it was always that they were trying to do that. The outcome, whatever the outcome was, that's what they meant to do. Okay. So now, if it had been the year 1995, and if Ukraine was able to use their entire military to attack Russia, and if all of NATO would get behind it, that would have been extraordinarily bad for Russia, because then they wouldn't have been able to handle Chechnya and ISIS, you know, Al-Qaeda, the whole thing would be a fucking shit show. We know it, right? So, you know, the plan to turn Ukraine against Russia, you know, happened, and that's what you see in this conflict. But this is why we introduced our subject today, talking about timelines, and that this is fundamentally a war of timelines, because just because the thing that they plan to do, they're able to pull it off at a certain time, right, doesn't mean that the time that they do it was time enough. It doesn't mean that when they got around to doing it, that it was in a timely way. Having, you know, look, if you were like a, just try to understand what's being said. Okay. If you were like a NATO intelligence, or if you were like a Langley, and you're like looking at how you would weaken the Russians at the time, the Soviet Union, right? Then you first of all, you don't like love the Ukrainians, because at that time that's all Soviet Union, right? You have your Ukrainians who are like the different ones. There's different waves of Ukrainian expatriate communities. It's far more complicated than just saying they're like this group, okay? That's like saying all the Iranians today in Ted Angeles, where I'm from, are like, you know, all left because the Shah was overthrown. Like, that's not just the case, you know, immediate in the immediate sense anymore, right? So the original plan was for Russia to be divided up into like 10 or 15 different countries further, right? But having Ukraine attack Russia would have greatly sped up that process of fracturing. We mentioned Chechnya just now. You have, you know, all these other entities that could also begin to act if the political class was captured, you see. And being able to capture the political class is a necessary function of, or is necessary outcome of the function of the activities of the IMF and the World Economic Forum. Like, when you look at like the vote at the UN Human Rights, right, Council to remove Russia from that, you know, Committee of Prestige, just, you know, it doesn't have any legislative, or it can't arrive at any binding decisions. The UN's already been destroyed at the level of the General Assembly. There's like this controlled movement for reforms, but what keeps it together is the Security Council at this point in time. That's the only thing that countries have used to justify the use of force, is a Security Council resolution. If the United States wanted to destroy, if the United States, or the cabal, to be more correct, wanted to destroy the UN, they would just do the same type of games that they've played in different countries, where the cabal interprets the constitution of that countries to allow for the parliament, right, to elect a president. That they're going to just interpret the constitution and you know, precedent and court rulings and the position of the courts in that sovereign state, and they're going to interpret the outcome of some resolution drawn at the level of the Senate or of the Congress to appoint a president, not based upon the outcome of a election that the, you know, even if they were able to call for a referendum, that would, you know, the election would be called for, right? So that happened in Pakistan just recently. That happened in Venezuela when they put up, when John Bolton, mustache boy, John Bolton was put up to try to get Juan Guaido recognized. And what did Trump say? I love when Trump says these things. What did Trump say? He said, Guaido seems weak. This guy, he can't be the guy. this guy, when you look at, he says, when you look at Maduro, you're like, Maduro's strong. People are going to back Maduro. He's strong. Like the army, the police, like, come on, use your head, right? It was great that Team Trump, like, set up John Bolton on that failure, because all the assets, like the Juan Guaido asset and everything, comes out of Team Clinton. Just so you know, that was the thing behind it. All these, like, all the Latin America games come out of Team Clinton, just so people understand how the actual thing works. Not out, all the Latin America games don't come out of Team Trump, just so people understand how that dynamic works. Okay. Just for whatever it is. I'm not God. I'm not a, you know, fly on any wall in any of those rooms, but that's, you can look at it and see that, you know, how that works on the inside is, you know, we can only speculate, but, all the games, like the, all the problems in Honduras, Team Clinton, murdered this woman there who was like this huge human rights organizer and had ties to labor and to some politics there. But she was, they murdered her. And this is a common practice, you know, but it's what Pompeo, you know, has his hand in some of that stuff too, at some level, I would imagine. But overtly, you know, Team Clinton was all up in that stuff. When they created the human caravan, the refugee caravan, right? So that's how we approach the subject. With the eternal victim, how that gets manipulated, how that gets turned on its head. There's no limit to the retribution that the permanent victim feels entitled to. There's no limit to that entitlement, because it's driven by this fomented and concocted condition of permanent rage, permanent insult. And just like in all intimate relationships, which different peoples in a society are necessarily going to have, the only practical thing is to decide. You can have your own reasons for what you accept or don't accept. At the end of the day, you're accepting or rejecting a social contract. You don't need to verbalize every reason for where you know your boundaries are. You can just make the agreement that works. But it has to be about moving forward together. And that's a very similar situation with Ukraine. Same, very similar situation inside the U.S. is a very similar situation like in Ukraine. Because they are, have a victim mentality. And we described on this show what drives that and what that looks like. And we gave a physical description of that. And then I guess Arestovich himself was listening to the show, or, you know, maybe because he and I have some similar work experience, that we just arrive at similar obvious things, I suppose. Like that imagery. So yeah, we had discussed that the power of the victim is like, if you were to visualize it as like like in those horror movies where the girl gets like horribly, I won't even say, you know what I mean, but multiple men invade the house. And then the rest of the movie is like she's getting revenge on them, like killing them in different ways. Kind of like Rambo almost, but more brutal. So, that is the, you know, the ultimate expression is when you saw these Ukrainian politicians, we're talking about like prime ministers and leaders of the Senate talking in front of, you know, thousands of people and on regular TV saying, you know, we have to burn the Russians to the ground. We have to burn the country to the ground, burn the fields, you know, kill the women and the children. Like, it's kind of, what is this stuff? What? So as we said at the top of the hour, it was like, you can see the difference in how the soldiers are. You can see the difference in how the soldiers are interacting, right? Only having 37 to trade. Yeah, they could be trying just changing the agreement backwards to, as we had been talking about before, just changing the agreement, like just bad faith bargaining, bad faith negotiating. Oh, you know, maybe we'll hold the other 300 and we'll release, you know, 37 of them or whatever, right? I mean, because then you have more to trade for something later. But they wanted 300-400 for those 37. But it made people think that there were very big doubts that the Ukrainians even had, you know, more than 40 people still alive. I mean, there were people on the George Soros finance television across the country, guys saying that, you know, Ukrainians need the land, Ukrainians need the resources, but we have a surplus population of people in the West and, you know, they can be killed or destroyed. And people, sleuthers got out about, you know, looking at the logo of the TV station that appeared on that in the show, and then just dug a little bit, like how many, you know, you Google that up, you know, you search and you see, oh, wow, Soros is the primary philanthropist behind that show or that network or whatever, right? What? It's openly calling, it's open like Nazism, right? And, you know, there's, then this is what has to be kind of understood, right? Because Nazism had different beliefs, right? There was the anti-Jewish part, which was very prominent. And that was a huge aspect of consequences for people in areas that they controlled, right? But the general ideology of the kind of the German identity is sort of like, as opposed to the Slavic identity, right? As we discussed in March, at a certain time in history, all of the area of what is East Germany, like what we call East Germany as a former political unit, but those regions, because within German culture, they kind of make fun of the guys from the East and stuff still. They say they're a certain way, you know, whatever. But there's still like that thing, that East-West thing. But in the distant past, East Germany was a land called Sorbia. And within Sorbia, or at distinct times there and before or after, there were what are called Bella Croatians and Bella Serbians. Right? How there's like Belarusians there was like Bella Croatians and Bella Serbians. And it doesn't mean white. It seems to mean West on the meaning of the cardinal map of the Persian Empire that had been borrowed by the Greeks for some time. But it just, I think it's like white is West and green is North. I think black is South and red is East. I think, but I'm not, I have to get back to that. I promise I will. I know it's very interesting. So the Great Reset depended upon going sort of macroscopic again to just what we began with at the beginning of the show. The Great Reset depended upon the destruction of Russia. And what better way at an earlier time than to have set Ukraine against Russia? Like, if you could get, just think about the Soviet Union, you can like spark a fucking civil war in the Soviet Union, like you're winning, right? Like you've got Ukraine fighting Russia now. Great. Okay. Let's pick a side and then get them to kill each other. And why am I saying that? Oh, what? Either one? Well, whatever has the best outcome of just the self-destructing the thing is the side that you back. It doesn't, Ukrainians picked the wrong friends. It's so sad. It makes you angry. It makes you sad. And people were trying to tell them, like, guys, the Nazis are crazy and the West is going to use you. And they don't really care about either your nation, and they don't look at what they've done to other nations, right? So, and why would the cabal care about that, right? And then look at what the Nazi, like, what ends up happening with that story. That's like predictive programming. It's like, why in the hell would you model yourself after history's fucking losers? Right? You talk about, see, now, that's why I talk about the victim ideology, right? How that was used, that was imported into this story. It had been a common trope. If you actually look at like cry-bully Nazism, cry-bully Nazism, especially like post-war Nazism, was real, like, woe is me and stuff, And that's real strange because it's kind of like contradictory to the ideology of like, woe to the vanquished, like, all right, you lose, you'll lick our boots, like, this is the warrior way, my friend, you win big by the sword, you conquer the land, blood and soil, it's like the Teutonic Order, right? And God backs us on top of that, right? So just think about it like that, right? Now, the elites would love to have gotten Russia and Ukraine fighting against each other, right? But they couldn't. They wouldn't, right? They weren't able to. They just didn't have the support when it would have been like the perfect time to do it, like maybe when Yeltsin was president sometime, right? And, but they, and just think overall then about the cabal's ability to exert force. Like they weren't like, if they had this, they can just print limitless money and they control every secret society. It's like, get off it. This is the gargoyle effect. They're making you think that they're more powerful than they really are. Like they would have been able to get into Chechnya harder. They would have been able to get into Dagestan harder. They would have been able to have Ukraine build up an army of 400,000 and with all modern, Abrams tanks and, Patriot systems or whatever they had in 95. So that was, any rate, they would have attacked, right? They just, no. They were playing different games. It doesn't mean that the Russian army could conquer the world, but the cabal is primarily a financialist order, and on the on the exoteric level, on the outward level, they're primarily a financialist operating system, right? And so the way that they interacted with the military was to like extract all this like, you know, imaginary product through extortionate prices through the military industrial complex, correct? Correct. So when they talk about, oh, the U.S. military budget, it is blah, blah, blah. And then that you're supposed to translate that to what other countries' budgets are is a nonsensical and half retarded way to understand power, because those are the build numbers. It's that's like $80 toilet seats and $20 lug nuts. You see what I'm saying? Like, and you're like, oh, they spent, you know, $95 trillion. It's like, well, yeah, but no, you know, yeah, but no, that just privatized back into the hands of the shareholders of these companies that get the contracts, and they, you know, They produce a very small product for that, which is what military force actually has to be the product of that. There's a very small product in return for that. And they just use that and they reinvest that into other components of the economy. So it basically means that the, you know, the military industrial complex with that extraordinary high levels of taxpayer, you know, derived income, then turn that back into the economy. Now, your next research project is to relate how the relationship between the military industrial complex and Vanguard BlackRock. That's your next research assignment, guys. So in understanding that the Great Reset is failing, okay, it's not the time, it's not the thing that they're doing or the thing that's happening. It's when they were able to finally get that to happen. Right. If they had limitless power, they would have done all things instantaneously. There's a lot of contradictions with the way that power is handled and power is managed. But, you know, when you have elites that exist at such a level of power within one part of the world, there's a certain logic to the that, you know, that's a mechanical function of the way that one, that when the abstract concept of power, when it becomes actual actions that you're doing in the world, there's a, you know, counterweight of other forces pulling in other actual directions. And this is why we continue to reinforce on this program the understanding that the elites constantly use a gargoyle effect. And they also, and there's a secondary consequence of this, but what they also do is they want to make you trust other people less and make you think that other regular people are all at some, you know, secret level, like just as demented as they are, as the ruling class is. So then you're like thinking like, oh, at every given turn, you know, human nature and stuff. And while there are aspects of human nature in this fallen state that we're in a theological sense, you know, that are necessarily flawed, right? We have tools like Christianity to have self-reflection and understand that, you know, we are the biggest problem in our own lives, right? But that's a tremendously liberating idea. That's what we began talking on this episode, you know, of this show about. This is a tremendously liberating idea that you're responsible for what happens to you. Because at any given time in the future, in your life moving forward, you have the power to decide what you agree to. Getting stuck and listing a list of past grievances and then like showing that list to someone and being like, I'm not going away until you agree to this list, is like almost a distraction. You have your reasons. You don't need them to recognize your reasons. You just agree to what you're going to agree to or don't agree to it. So, but when we think in terms of classes of victims and do the oppression Olympics, we're necessarily going to end up in this kind of dramatical play, this excessive scripted stage event. All of the television personalities uttering the necessary shibboleths, and, you know, people are in general placated. But they want you to be angry with your fellow man. They want you to think that most of the people are a big part of the problem. Not even most of the Ukrainian military is a big part of the problem. They get shot if they don't follow orders. They're just recruited from guys that didn't have like 1,300 euros to buy their way out of this awful draft that these, you know, their leaders picked the wrong friends in the world who didn't care. It's like if your parents handed you over to child molesters, it's an awful thing. Of course, Ukrainians hate their own oligarchy. They hate Akhmatov and Kolomoisky and all of these guys. They just don't understand the relationship between the funding and the national movements, because that's considered like a conspiracy theory in Ukraine. They just like that doesn't make sense, because, you know, Akhmatov is Muslim and Kolomoisky is Jewish, so why would they be the ones so much involved in Pravi Sector and Azov and Zelensky and how this all fits together? That's a conspiracy theory. No, they think, no, the national battalions, like, these are the heroes, and they have so much power because they're armed, because the people support them, and through, you know, thousands of donations, and they bought all of this equipment themselves, and they're shaking down Kolomoisky, they're shaking down Akhmatov. Like, this money they get is because they're shaking them down. See how, like, when they go in the streets and they can take anyone in parliament and beat them up and throw them in the trash or tie them to a pole. I mean, that's the state of things in Ukraine if you haven't paid attention. I don't see how things can get any worse after whatever Russia's going to do. Like, there's any number of things that Russia may do afterwards. I don't have a crystal ball. I'm aware of the theories, and we could talk about the rationale for the likelihood of those. But, you know, no one has a crystal ball. A lot of things can happen. I mean, there's a lot of things get floated just to be like, this is our position right now, you know, and maybe that's the legal position to have, even though on your own secret contingency plans, you know that things can pop off in a much crazier direction. And you know that very easily, you know, whatever the Russians have claimed at the beginning, that the land that they might take is limited to, you know, areas like DPR and LPR. We already know that's not the case. We already know that, like, you know, Kherson and some of these others are going to pop off. Kharkov. So makes perfect sense. We talked about that. There's no other way. I mean, they're invested, you know, in terms of blood and treasure, the difference of the amount more that it would be required to, you know, liberate those would be just far, far more rational, far more absorbed into the overall cost of the procedure, as opposed to freezing the conflict and then thinking that in 10 years you're going to, you know, have to perfectly rebalance the diplomatic situation with Europe, perfectly rebalance, you know, the threat expectation, contain it to Ukraine, roll in your army, then the actual war part of the thing. I mean, you know, it just makes much more sense to just take all that fucking shit now. You see what I'm saying? Like, take all that now while they're there. So, but I don't think that legally they could be introducing that into the public discourse is like, this is what we think we're doing, like, for the historical record. You see what I'm saying? Like, they're just like, oh, well, wherever the army is, and then people are now having these referendums, like, you know, like, right, we're not naive people. Like, we're talking about this, I think, in realistic terms. Like, wherever the army is, that is what liberated means. And then they will have a referendum that aligns with, like, wow, magical, that aligns with the political orientation of the army that liberated them. Like, wow, that's pretty, you know, symmetrical, right? So, I mean, we're not children, right? The question is, like, however you want to, like, imagine these referendums or whatever the political processes are going on, from the perspective of realism, like, I'm not going to speak to the legitimacy or not, or the, you know, information war or not of like that end of the spectrum of what you see happening with new referendums that will pop off. I'm just saying like the geopolitical outcome at this point has to be, you know, whatever Russia's process for legitimizing that is, just from a strategic perspective, they need to take that shit. They need to take all of that shit. They got to take it all from basically everything. I would say, you know, just based on the investment now, and once they, you know, kind of encircle, or how are they going to liquidate or otherwise handle surrender that force of whatever 55,000 there in the east, in that middle zone. I think if they can encircle them, of course, that's what a lot of the actual operations and movements have been right now. We saw just recently Reshetnikov, right, who's someone who supervised a project I work in the past, as I was explaining. He's you know, Lieutenant General of the Russian Foreign Intelligence and Service, and he's retired now. And if there's such a thing. And what he said was that that the Ukrainian side, backed by NATO, you know, satellite and related and other aerial, were actually able to see a lot, and to have, and through the satellites were generating a computer program thing that then adjusted like the strike calibrations for each weapon. For each piece they had in the field, the calibration numbers were being calculated through Poland, where the where Reshetnikov says that the military command operates from Poland. The Ukrainian, you know, command. So for once some of these forces are neutralized, it's, I think, I'm not going to say cakewalk, right? Because it's going to be a lot of new things happening on the other side. They're going to, you know, Ukraine's going to is, I think, now in the process of trying to raise another army. And we, you know, this is what we've talked about, you know, 6 months, a year of this conflict. It's not what happens to your first army. It's like, how quickly can you raise, train, and equip and make functional with, you know, within your doctrine, with use of other pieces and, you know, artillery, how can you get those? How many tanks do you need? I mean, it's not just raising human beings and having a march around for 3 weeks and then sending them out. That's why you have the scandal with the German tanks. That's why you have the threat of the German, well, effectively the parliament, to somehow pressure an outcome of these tanks that only have 4,000 rounds of ammunition that Germans can supply with them. Germany said, we only have ammunition for a war that lasts 4 days. Do you remember? You guys remember that? Wasn't that great? So, indeed. Let me see here. Yeah. All right, I'm back. I was just looking at your comments and stuff real fast, just kind of seeing, like, you know, if there was like a people just I just checked to see if like if the audio's off or something, if something happened, whatever. I guess we're good. The Great Reset. Sorry, just circling back to my notes. The Great Reset failing depended on destruction of Russia. Things that you see that they do are things that they had long planned about. So even though you find documents or FOIA releases or, you know, good sleuthing or credible, you know, accounts from former people involved with it or whatever. I mean, just because, you know, you have those out there. But just keep in mind that when those things are done and to what degree they're effective, which are related but also distinct. But certainly if you're pulling something off much later, or if you're forced to do it prematurely, or any number of things, right? Time. Okay, too soon, too late, right? The timing of the crescendo to the outcome and how all the pressure and the things come together is like a super important thing. If America falls, the world falls in the West. In the West. And different Western countries may have kind of different variations of constitutional systems where the legislature is weaker, or where the courts are more subordinate to electoral politics at the in terms of a constant pressure on how the public understands constitutional law. Like, that's a tall order, right? So the aspects and themes and attempts of the Great Reset were you'll see more being rolled out. And this is simply how organizations do things. That's really actually just a pretty normal recommended practice, is you roll out the pieces that you have completed. I mean, you've invested in them and they'll have some effect and you'll do something. And maybe unknown things will happen, or maybe you were overprepared and you're going to, you know, you just don't know. You got to do the thing that you can do sort of at a certain point with the things that you've already invested in doing them. And also the whole thing, because and we explained in prior episodes, actually, that in organizational power dynamics, that you have, any sort of sense of lack of certainty among the leadership, and a lot of people that kind of have like other options, you know, at that level, you know, people may have other options. Maybe in the private sector, maybe they are in the private sector, maybe in another, you know, vertically organized, integrated corporatist entity, you know, they would be, you know, just as happy to go work for someone else. So, because they know the score, you know what I mean? Like, and people are not having happy lives, like working in these mega corporations, right? So it's a danger to allow them to create the reaction, the talking points of the direction that they want to take things, okay? Just so much focus on what they want to do and what they think is going to happen next, even though you have to really understand to try to connect their words to their actual thinking and their actual capacity to do it are very important to study. Right. But to just let what they're saying without critically deconstructing it, just to allow what they're saying to set the agenda. And then you're being like, oh, this is horrible. So this is the future. Oh, well, damn. Yes. And there's evidence of everywhere. I think I'm going crazy. Oh, my God. You know, it's like, no. That's what they want you in, that kind of paranoid. They want you in a to have a sense of, you know, you're overwhelmed by it and you're being defeated. They want that. That's why it's a satanic power, by the way. Not to get, you know, too metaphysical with you, but that's how it works, right? So that's probably the best way to understand how all those pieces fit together. The Great Reset failing, not because the things that they claim they were going to do aren't things that you see them like kind of rolling out. It's when those things are happening. And there's two other factors that are, and this is what we said at the very beginning of the show, there are two other factors that are kind of moving along side by side with this, and that is the Great Awakening and the actual unraveling, or the control over the fourth industrial revolution is falling apart. They're using the word fourth industrial revolution, but on the front end of that, their proposal involves a longer process and heavier investment into increasing the coercive capacities of certain technologies at the expense of to create a human population number shift to affect a massive and sudden human population number shift downwards, to justify that to maintain some economy of scale required the robots to do that, to come back in since the people were gone. Of course, that's nonsensical. You know, whatever the human population is at any given time, there is a way to divide the division of labor, like within that population, to provide for everyone, because you could provide for everyone because that total number of everyone is less. So you don't need as many, you know, if a lot of workers in industry suddenly die from some mystery, global mystery illness, or for whatever other reason related to that, and I mean for whatever other reason related to that, then that's your new population. And it takes much less time that you have job openings in places where people have died. But then again, your total necessary output is necessarily a lower demand. So there's less need for even people to do that. You don't have to replace everyone who dies. You only need to replace that kind of necessary related portion of the population that's still alive to the new, you know, work balance of when you replace people when they've died from some kind of global mystery illness or the government response to it, right? So now, that was supposed to go on for a long amount of time. That was supposed to go on for, you know, 3 years or something, maybe 7 years. Okay, now, this is why I said if America falls, the Western world falls. Because however, in the other Western countries that have been, you know, somewhere between part of the Western alliance and part subject to the cabal's use of the U.S. military to occupy your country, and I'm sorry for that, whether you're Germany or Iraq, but within the, you know, the Western way of approaching their timelines and their you know, the cabal, their way to have this happen in a way that works for them, you know, for them to win, right? They needed to divide Russia, make that sooner, have this Ukraine-Russia thing happening. See, that's great, okay, for them. Just think if you could get, you know, Texas and Nevada and California and Colorado and Utah and Arizona. Imagine if you can get all of them, right, fighting against the Midwestern states, the Northern states, and the East Coast, the, you know, New England states. Imagine, and the Southern states, right? Imagine that, right? Like, but it's not, see, this conflict is happening far too late for the cabal, even though they're going to try to, you know, cope. They're going to write major backfill narratives that are major cope for them. Major cope being like, well, the fact that we got Russia-Ukraine fighting was one of our long-term strategic goals. Yeah, long-term until it was an expired strategic goal. Because at this point in time, any conflict, any military conflict between Russia and Ukraine just legitimizes, because Russia's going to win at this point. It's not like you're going to make it shatter and then the Chechens are going to, that's what we're talking about this, are going to make the Chechens succeed in their thing back, because they weren't, it was like the mind control Chechens. They were under the mind control of Al-Qaeda. Okay, their political leadership structures had been just like the Nazis by the same vectors, because ISIS and Ukrainian Nazis have the same kind of like thing going on in the background in terms of the power structures that manipulate them. Okay, so it's all the ex-Nazis integrated into the NATO security apparatus and all of these Atlanticist ventures. You know, have you seen how like the NATO symbol looks like actually like a swastika that's been like a democratized swastika or something like that? It looks like the blue guys, you know, the good guys. Blue and white, kind of like the UN. Blue and white. So we understand for all those reasons that the Great Reset is failing. Another thing that, you know, that happened is Bill Gates bought some land, but it wasn't that much land relative to the total amount of land, okay? And he was able to get his, you know, troll army online, the Bill Gates troll army, to run a special type of operation to make people think that Bill Gates had actually bought like most of the, there was like different rumors, like most of the land or all of the land or whatever. Look, he has bought land. It's not good. He doesn't want to do good things with them, but he didn't buy the majority of the land or something like this, or even like a third of it or something like that. So just when you look at the numbers and get into the details, you're like, okay. So, but he has a great interest, doesn't he? In terms of like, just if you're going to, you know, deal with him or invest with him, you know, you want people to think that you, that that bridge over there is yours to sell, you see. And of course you're going to assume that that he owns that bridge if he's that guy. Like if Bill Gates said he owns this building and he's selling it to you, or owns this, you know, intellectual property and he sells it to you, like, well, that's Bill Gates, you know they that's Microsoft could develop this, so they probably did, and is theirs to sell you, right? So just understand that this Great Reset is being pulled off by people whose job it is to like talk their book. What do you think else they're going to say? Like that we're losing, you know, that they're rolling things out because they have to maintain the appearance of rolling things out at one time or the other. I mean, they do determine when is the best out of a generally negative situation. They do determine like when is the best to roll things out. I mean, that's still possible, right? They have organization for that, but the fact they couldn't roll it out previously is their issue. previously they couldn't roll it out. They would have loved to have a lot of things done by 2012 or 2006. They would have had loved to have a lot of things taken care of by 2008. They did not get a very strong return, right, on the Arab Spring, right? And think about when they did the too big to fail bailout, and when they then decided to have a scheme where privileged parties in the stock market would buy up on these different exchanges, use all this money, the quantitative easing money, like a lot of this was put into cornering the market on all of like global food supply. And then jacking up the prices to make revolutions happen in countries in the Middle East. And then those were like bread protests that certain activists from certain NGOs that were more professional and could make signs and big banners, like you think that everyone's there for what that banner says. That you only need like 4 people or 20 people just to manage the banner part of the banner. And then, you know, that's how fronts work. That's how protests work. It's like a lot of people there for like a lot of less extremist reasons. And then an extremist group puts like a big banner in front of them. Does that make sense? But that's how, those are all both propaganda of the deed and organizing techniques that are used in so-called white hat organizing, even. Like, that's what's crazy about it. Like, even that right there is a white hat organizing technique. You know, black hat techniques involve, you know, agent provocateurs or pretending to have been injured when you weren't, or injuring other people or whatever. And all of these are, everything you saw in Kenosha was like, you know, real black hattery. Just the astroturf part of these color revolutions themselves is not, you know, necessarily bad. They're tools, you see. You can do justice with a gun, or you can be a murderer, right? You see? At a certain level, I think it's more likely that you would, you know, not necessarily exercise justice, but that you could. Let's take a 30-second intermission, and I'll be right back with you. All right, we are back. Now, the Great Reset, you really have to
really have to not approach your understanding from looking at just everything that they've done, but looking at everything that they should have been able to do if they have as much power as you might somehow otherwise think that they do. You see, there is tremendous power, social power in the population against these, you know, this resetist regime. There is tremendous resistance in the population. And there's tremendous resistance from other elites. But elites, you know, do a lot of horse trading and hedging and game playing and posing, posturing as well. And they kind of have to create this, even for the point of view of confusing their own competitors, you know, whether they're for real or playing just another game. I mean, let's be realistic about it, right? So, but resetism required certain things to happen at certain times. And they're constantly working away at how to plug in presently existing assets towards, you know, the least bad settlement or outcome for them. That's always a necessary factor, you know. There's still some ability to negotiate, you know, settlements that work. Even settlements that work for some, you know, extended period of time, you see. Parties would stick to them just because of the natural gravitation of how conflict and wars are done and how they're justified or rationalized, you see. That's why we have spent so much time on the work by Jervis on how statesmen think, on the psychology of international politics, the Robert Jervis text that we have focused on several times in our past discussions here on Telegram. And that being that states are pretty much unlikely to get into a war, to initiate a war, unless they see that the status quo is quickly eroding their capacity to exist, and it becomes an existential question. But the toleration of the status quo is like the default most prescribed, most justified, most professional approach to your diplomatic posture, if that makes sense. That's how you should orient to the world. That has been, you know, now, as we've discussed with the Western elite, their cabal, there is evidence of some, you know, of some looking at what's called elective warfare. And it's interesting that there's such a connection between the Clintons and the god of human sacrifice. Because
at the level that they operate, the belief structures that keep it all together, when we talk about Nazi occult organization, this Nazi occult, I was talking about this for like 2 years to the public. For 2 years, I've been talking about this. It's popular in circles to overemphasize the communist threat and to lump kind of like the communists and the Nazis into the same, you know, pot of, you know, same basket or whatever. But balances of freedom in the world in past geopolitical arrangements have shown that the victors of World War II agreed on the destruction of Nazism. And while this is not a prediction of future outcomes, you know, just one possible contingency out of numerous that are, you know, just by the way at their disposal, talking about the cabal, is to try at maybe at some point to work out an alliance with the Russians, if it's about an agreement on the, you know, to fund the war against, to finance and arm the war against the Russians on a certain level, but then on another level, enter a conflict on the side of the Russians to have a pretext justification to enter into the territory, military, the United States enter into the military territory of Europe itself, as in terms of being a liberating force against Europe, however, you know, Europe is, right? So, you know, people connected to Team Trump could be used for something like that. Like if the transatlantic thing was going to go bad and then you needed to like make it be something else, there's lots of, you know, ways, there's lots of ways that that works out, right? Don't think in terms of, you know, only the Democrats or the left is playing some game or the other. These things can get played by any, you know, number of sides. And so always keep that in mind and when you're assessing what's happening. And in looking at the decline of the Great Reset agenda, again, we reference how people pointed out the Bill Gates land purchase, but that did not turn out to be so much of what it was promoted as. Then you have to ask, like, how do they have a whole sector of the population that every time Bill Gates does something, that yes, it's true that he did it, and yes, it's true that this is a nefarious thing that he's trying to do and stuff, like they always, there seems to be like some sector of the internet culture that like leaps up into a state of hyperventilation, like, oh my God, like this isn't, like he's got this and now he controls us all. And that's exactly, for some magical reason, you know, troll and bot farms do exist, but for some magical reason, Bill Gates is able to get a bunch of people online to think that he he's, you know, running the show or something. He would love people to think that. That makes you think that this can't be stopped. It takes very little to stop it. For example, mass mobilizations actually work, but you also need to control local politics. But for the people of a city, see, the city people can use mass mobilization. But if you're rural, mass mobilization is not a tactic, is it? Right? That's, you actually need to actually, if you're rural, you probably need to like assert more local control from city governance and not be connected to or subject to their tax schemes, and then develop, use your own tax revenues through government or through like similar synergistic projects where you come in with an investor to build 3D printing and the fourth industrial revolution at a local level where you live. That's the race against time. That's what we're talking about in today's, you know, overall presentation that I've prepared for you. And we're going at great length to show how very much the events in Ukraine and Russia now are intimately a reflection of the overall defeat of the Great Reset. It's the Great Reset that's being defeated in Ukraine right now. The focus on Nazism is not a distraction because it's a real component of this, but it's not independent Nazism of an independent sovereign state the way that Nazi Germany was a sovereign state and its Nazi movement was like, you know, Germans were making the decisions, right, in Nazi Germany, you see? But in Ukraine, the decisions are made by a cabal that's actually the same cabal as the Fourth Industrial Revolution in their terms, like the Great Reset, you know, World Economic Forum version of this thing. Which, why we consistently explain here that they've used this term so that you don't look at it, because you're just like against it. And people, for some reason, don't study like the things that are maybe the arguments behind things that they're against, because they just don't. That's part of human nature. But you need to understand the Fourth Industrial Revolution to know that they're hiding behind it. And the logic of most of it happens at a decentralized level. Today's talk is clearly about how the Great Reset is failing and the relationship between the victimology, the victim mentality that's used in the by the Ukrainians. It's pretty intense. And but the solutions can't be to call all of the Ukrainian as Nazis or whatever. There's something called manufactured consent, which, you know, Noam Chomsky wrote about. But number one, I don't agree with much of Noam Chomsky anyway. But number two, he actually co-wrote that book. Anyhow, so, but in manufacturing consent, his focus is different, but the underlying idea is that, you know, what people think is also like a product of the industrial process. The industrial, you know, how the, system of, you know, mechanized production from the, you know, first through third industrial revolutions, you know, through especially the first and second industrial revolution, so heavily focused on mechanized production, you can then see like how the production of ideas through the lens of like an intentional ideological outcome is also a product of the industrial revolution. Like, you couldn't have such precise ideologies expressed in detail at scale. Like, people believe things more vaguely, more generally, like in the 19th century and before. I mean, it was only like, you know, in the area of like philosophers and theologians had very, you know, complex, you know, rationale behind their commitments, you know, their intellectual or you know, polemical commitments, whether that's through theology or politics or what have you, right, in the past. But now with the age of the political soldier, right, and the fact that man in general is capable of having beliefs that are justified through complex, you know, theologies or polemical arguments or political orientations. I mean, they're very complex, all these ideologies, right? And that is a product of, you know, also the same modernity that produces the Industrial Revolution. That's the same product of, you know, now the time that people can write, now the time people have to go to school so they can work in these factories, so they can learn to read, to work in these growing bureaucracies, and right? So it was a necessary thing that these, you know, managerial type revolutions would have happened, you know, in the Soviet Union or in, you know, the US with Roosevelt, or in Europe with fascism, right? But the differences between them are far more important than their similarities when we construct, you know, that category of managerial revolutions, right? Like the Russian Revolution wasn't a workers and peasants revolution, right? It was like a revolution by an intellectual group who had a vision for the what society should be structured like. And then that same group, you know, tried to implement that vision, right, as those in power. And the reference to like workers and peasants is a matter of the belief system that legitimated their organization and was those, you know, numbers of people from those classes had, where possible and where they were organized, you know, by the left in Russia, would, you know, mobilize them to turn up to these things that they called popular assemblies. And then those people that they had mobilized to these places on these stages that they had themselves, you know, Bolsheviks had constructed the stages, and then invited, you know, and organized people in what was being presented as their best interests. And in these formative years, you know, they often were, so they aligned. You see, the revolutionary movement of the Bolsheviks in the early years was to align with like the, you know, broader interests of the people involved in the first and second Industrial Revolution dynamic. And so now it's only these studies like in human tragedy or the limits of reality that, like, you know, we look at the problems that arose in the Soviet Union as examples of like human folly, or, you know, and that's not to say that the cabal, you know, there are reasons that the Western power was not created by the cabal, you know, that's the thing that is Western power, unless you think only in terms of like military power and then the specific organization of society on this concept of the consumer society, right? If you define Western power by that, then yes, it's like somehow connected to the cabal. But the foundation of that, which made those possible outgrowths possible, was not the cabal, right? There were other practical and real forces in the world that actually were expressions of historical progress in the sense of people in motion doing things, right? The cabal are not the movers or those who inspire functional or stable states. They're produced at a later stage in the development of cultures and civilizations, where after a long period of there being more crystallized over time relationships between moments of corruption or opportunities of corruption, which every system necessarily produces, and those being transformed over time into permanent networks and permanent, and for those fluid moments of corruption to develop crystallized supply chains. And then that begins to become just like a sort of cancer growing on your society. So, but that's only produced, the corruption is produced as a consequence of the tremendous surplus and wealth that the society is producing. So America was already a wealthy and industrious and industrial society before the cabal took over. So just because we can have a very correct genealogy of the members of the cabal and you can trace the relatives back to the 1700s and stuff like that, that doesn't mean that they had absolute power in society at that time, just because they have grandparents that had a similar name for their bank or carry the same family name or whatever the concern may be. You understand? We just back reference them and be like, oh, they were already doing banking, or they already owned a bunch of coal mines, or they whatever back then. But there were many more wealthy families in the past. There were many more wealthy families in the past. And it's the ruling class that's been at war with itself for, you know, a very long time. And they just, you know, their exploitation or oppression of regular people is just a consequence of that class war between the elites and amongst themselves. And so long as they can make peace through agreeing on the mutual exploitation or whatever of the other social classes in society, or maybe against or upon people of other nations, right, then their competition within themselves can be, you know, relatively checked by the overall general tendency towards mutual prosperity among their class. But once the empire and all these things began to kind of collapse because the rest of the world effectively industrialized and reached, you know, even the so-called developing world has basically reached the second and third industrial revolutions. So you can't, it's not like the past where you had a second and third industrial revolution society, you know, able to benefit from an imbalanced power relationship. This is a kind of the theme of the victim thing that we're talking about, but to benefit from an imbalanced power relationship with some other given state for some period of time. Okay. But all those leaders of those countries in the developing world, if they had a sound sort of econometrics, you know, a macroeconomic perspective, they could look at the ledgers in small, but also look back at the general tendency of things. They understood that even bad deals with Western countries would develop them to a certain point that would then empower them to revisit existing agreements, you know, at a later time, but not that far in the distant future, just another 20 or 30 years. A lot of countries did this, but of course they had, you know, radical movements within them that were saying it's not fast enough or not good enough, or that they were selling the country out. And the cabal loves that. They love that propaganda that the left and the communists would produce, you know, saying that the non-communist national leaders were necessarily selling the country out just because they were playing a certain card of relationships or a reality, playing a reality matrix a certain way, where later they would. I mean, just look at Brazil. Just look at Brazil, right? They were never a communist state. So, and the state always, for long periods of time, had these right-wing military dictatorships. But then they did have populist leaders from the left later on, like Lula, right? And so now we're, even though there was the big thing with, like, I'm just talking about Brazil, just to understand, like, this country was like, didn't have like in the North American, you know, and European perspective, there was a lot of ignorance about Brazil. But Brazil is a very wealthy country in terms of its natural resources, and for the past, you know, century, its human resources. And it actually kept up a lot much more than people thought with Western development, like even in the 19th century. Okay. So despite that, the U.S. cabal, deep state, Nazi, whatever alliance did games in Brazil with the political structures. And even though they owned and had all this investment into Brazil, right, it over time still allowed capital to some degree of capital to concentrate and retain in capital intensive and capital concentration centers in Brazil, so that over time they would invest and build to the position they are now, which is tremendously more sovereign, right? And they're not less or more sovereign than any country which in the 20th century decided to take a communist direction, you see? So even though that balance of the Cold War in the, you know, 50s and 60s and 70s primarily, you know, for that period of time, for those kind of like three and a half decades, was a tremendous opportunity for developing countries to kind of have a choice, to a kind of a game to, you know, that helped just the competition, just the fact that the cabal didn't control the whole world, but there was also the communists on the other side who are not the cabal. There's different powers in the world. The Freemasons are not the Satanists. The communists are not the cabal. These are all different groups, and there's groups within groups. This idea that it's one big behemoth monster and all these different entities are just like its little finger puppets on the tips of its hands and shit, or like, that's how the cabal propaganda operates in the world. It plays upon your fears. It plays upon the fact that you're not naive, because you're aware that there's such a possibility for like uncontrolled power, uncontrolled wealth as a desire, as an aim. You realize that that is possible in the world, because that evil does exist in the world. But another thing that evil does is it makes you think that it's more powerful than it is. That's how it captivates you. That's how evil captivates you in its snare. That's how it holds you transfixed in a kind of hypnotic state, you know, paralysis by analysis, and you're just looking at with, you know, bewildered eyes all this crazy stuff, this all powerful things, you know, this five-dimensional chess that the cabal is playing, and you know how every which way things go is still their plan. And that's just not how reality works. Of course, you have contingency plans, even in a state of operating to prolong or to negotiate the best possible result of your exit or defeat or a compromised result, or, you know, buying time for an X factor. Maybe a volcano erupts, or there's a big storm, or another virus, or a sunspot, or, you know, some great catastrophe. So, you know, holding on time, just like delaying payments, right? The same principle of delaying, you know, expediting incomes, expediting the receival of incomes, and delaying as long as possible the, you know, outflow of necessary payments, right? That's like the fundamental, you know, business practice for, you know, the black hatters, right? So it's a black hat trick. Anyhow, you can see that you can't look at their own sort of victory parades as being the bellwether of what the real position of power is. Just because they control the media and do this like self-congratulatory thing, and they do the thing, and you know, mind control over Beyonce or whatever, fucking Sasha Fierce and stuff, and you're like, oh, look at that, it's a big satanic cabal. Well, yeah, it is, guys, but you know, Satan always loses, number one. I mean, you should laugh at these people. Just keep your kids away from them, but focus on the positivity, not on the judgments. They want you to react like with disgust, because that emotion of hatred and disgust actually feeds their gods. See, they trick you into worshiping at their altar of hatred and disgust by provoking hatred and disgust from you onto them. They already got you in their matrix of hatred and disgust, because they are creatures of hatred and disgust. They hate themselves, okay? So like, when you hurl the expletives and when you direct your hatred at them, you're like, oh, they're like, thank you, these are our prayers. In our religion, these are our prayers, because, you know, our God hates us. Because the world is evil, and we just have to get what's ours for ourselves, and fuck you all, everyone else. Just party and be alive while you can, enjoy it, and when you're dead, you're dead. And, you know, let people think they're Satan, even though Satan doesn't really control us, even though we always have to acknowledge the power that Satan has, even though we don't think God exists, and we just use that as a game to troll the Christian conservatives or whatever. They all have all kinds of excuses. That's a very specific, you know, thing. Don't let them manipulate you. Keep the love strong, keep the, you know, keep the forgiveness and the this attitude, you know, but by the grace of God go I. It's always a test. Don't pray at the altar of their religion of hatred and disgust. They're trying to provoke, like when they put, remember that poor kid, that poor skinny like 6-year-old kid, and his parents, or his, I don't know, his legal, you know, gay married parents, guardians, were dressing him up as like a girl. And he was calling himself like the first trans 6-year-old or the first trans 7-year-old. And they would bring him out to like gay pride parades and stuff. And it looked like they were kind of letting people do stuff with him almost. That was kind of like the vibe. I have no accusations. I'm just saying, like, you know, I didn't see anything, but that was like the vibe that was being put out. And I think kind of clearly so, right? Because that kind of fits in with different explanations, whether they're trolling that or whether they really do that or whatever. But they, you know, always try to make the conversation surround that, don't they? Yeah. So I think it's a very good, you know, summary of our of the present situation. You see the Great Reset not surviving. Like people, I mean, I have a whole list of things that we talk about. BlackRock, Vanguard, oh, they're buying houses at 30% over market price. Well, did you know that the housing bubble coming back is actually a concession? Is it a sign of defeat on that? That they have to inflate another bubble right now? In other words, to try to keep the game going, that they're trying to collapse? Like you were not supposed to have a vaccine for like 3 to 7 years or something like this. And during that time that you were going to lose your house. This is why we're talking about America. I don't know about like if it doesn't matter how. In the United States, we have 50 different states, and each state actually has more authority than the federal government's inexpressed authority on things which are not within the domain of federal law. So it's really like 50 different countries in a way of thinking about it, okay? In a way of thinking about it. And therefore, things can be retained or overdone or changed at the level of the state or enforced at the level of the state. And so our national mask or national vaccine mandates were actually largely distilled through the authorities at each state level. Okay. And now, being able to do a lockdown, right, is premised upon the idea that there is not a treatment that is available. Okay. And yes, because they wanted the vaccine, like in 3 to 7 years from now, to be the only one that was considered the one that you could take, is why hydroxychloroquine and these other ones were not allowed, right? Is at least the, I'm just recounting the conspiracy theory, mind you, in our completely entertainment driven only, you know, talk today of what conspiracy theorists think is true. And, you know, maybe in 6 months, this isn't a conspiracy theory, right? So Vanguard having to pay 30%, 40% over market for houses means that people are not evicted, and there isn't an oversupply now of empty houses that, you know, banks have repossessed and then had to, you know, put back on the market. Now, it's true that they don't necessarily either mark to market or put back onto market all the houses that they've possessed. They didn't do that in 2008 either. And in fact, because they had to keep the system going, they reinforced the real value of the housing. They reinforced the inflated value of the housing market by not marking to market or putting back on the market the houses that had been repossessed during the 2008 end of the housing market crisis, you see? So all of these, to me, indicate that they're not getting out of this what they wanted to get out of it. When you look at the scope of the production, like they could have just called this another market crash. Did you understand? Like so far, the things that kind of like happen because the vaccine came out so fast, were just kind of like, oh, it was another market crash. And okay, they It was a big one, though. It was bigger than the last one, because eventually we are heading towards a zero point we've talked about, right? And but now this is just, you know, having to shut down the whole economy. The way it works is that when Americans lose their jobs, maybe they just lose their houses, and then you have, you know, some other problem. For most people, it becomes a pressure onto other family members or something like this. For many other people, it becomes homelessness. And yet for others, and statistically significant, so it becomes suicide. Then there's the, you know, lack of access to health insurance, because in the U.S. you don't have any access really, unless you really know the game. And that's like not a common, you can't just walk up and get service, you know, so for health needs, right? So then basically in the U.S. you get a spike in the death rate that's even higher than in Western Europe, but it's something like 30,000 deaths per 1% increase of unemployment sustained for over a year. So then you multiply that by the, you know, the factor is, one, you had what, 4% unemployment, or something like that, or 3.5% unemployment when with Trump, right? And then all of a sudden it's from just how they were having the economy run with a lot of the actually quantitative easing continued to go on, by the way, anyway. But there was a just a moment. Yeah, so I'm back. They were going to be buying these houses at pennies on the dollar, you know, maybe 70 cents on the dollar or whatever. I mean, you know, by paying 30% over, they're kind of just working against, they're just paying market price against the 30% inflation in one way of looking at it, right? But it's like their dollars don't apply to them, right? But that is still a good position to be if you're a homeowner right now. And it's going after homeowners that is a huge, you know, sign of success for all great resetism. Now the argument working against that is that the inflated home values work against you getting new homeowners, right? Which, works overall against the interest of more people being homeowners, which gives people more investment in their communities where they live, the outcomes, the schools. You know, you can't just throw money at schools or throw money, right, at things, at public institutions. They have to be the practical public utilities of the people who live there, who are, you know, the real stakeholders in that community, right? Stakeholder societies at the community level are the correct approach, right? That's why they play all these games with the language, these different word games, so that you don't look at these ideas at all, like what shareholders and stakeholders really are. Like, we all are the shareholders and stakeholders. Having a society like that is a good thing, but it's called a constitutional democracy, a republic. That's what it's called. It's sort of like trying to switch out, play the word games between international law and a rules-based system. You're like, well, I guess in a sense, rules are like laws. So I thought I would address then just how the things happening in the West under the cabal with the housing market is not as negative as it would otherwise be. I mean, of course, there's a tension point between people who aren't homeowners and people who are homeowners, because the value of the real estate is making it possible for them to continue to spend, kind of in a sense, and have a and have access to personal capital that, in a very realistic, better system that we could live in now, you would just have more credit unions that would allow people that. So it has created this problem, and that helps these big companies that build these big apartment blocks and stuff like that. And then, you know, you're the never ending credit check process. I mean, this is all part of their privatization of the system. You know, if access to housing is based upon your social credit score, which is what you've had already. See, people don't really follow my train all the time, right? Y'all have had social credit for a long time in the United States. The thing they're doing in China that they're trying to make you think that's what's coming next. No, that's they've adapted our social credit system to Chinese conditions, just like everything else that they do. We already had the FICA score. They didn't have a FICA score. Did you know that? Right? And we've had social security numbers that are like a single number that works nationwide. You know, China was more decentralized than the United States on these like registration things, registrations of persons, registrations of business entities. So they had to create, because see, like one of the lessons that we learn on the show is that when we, from the perspective of the outside looking in, other countries are always like appear more monolithic than they really are, you see. But inside of those countries, there's all kinds of different institutions and things going on. And social credit where we are in the West is actually already worse, because it's like if you're a renter, your credit score affects your ability to pay rent, even though you're still paying a first month's, last month's, and security deposit, all, you know, equal maybe in many states to, you know, three or four times the rent to move in, which are all like different types of insurances against if you can't make rent 1 month and you're out the next. And then, you know, the overall ratio of rented to vacant apartments is within the business mean of normal of profitable for these, you know, big companies that run that way. That's a far more crazy, messed up system than what has existed in China up until recently. You see, so just understand that a lot of ways that we interpret information, if it's from the perspective or lens of like if you're a property owner or a retiree, or you only have another 10 or 20 years or 10 or 15 years to retirement, you've had it hard, but recently it's been easier than the overall historical mean, and now it's coming back to that historical mean. So societies are using that generational conflict in a weaponized way, but there's been a distortion of conservative ethics used to stigmatize a younger generation, even though those opportunities in fact do not exist. It's not about making them or the power of positive thinking, or, you know, in fact, these things don't exist, unless you also want to redefine your ethics towards crime, because the more that crime can be gotten, then you kind of create out of people able, because it's like, if there's no, this is why crime happens. Okay. If there's no way that people have reasonable access to things like capital, right, when you're young, to take risks, to engage in high risk behavior, which is what a lot of entrepreneurship is when you're young. Without that access to capital, these same people that have the same ability to, this is like what New Jack City was kind of about, even though the message was kind of lost, the film New Jack City, right? These are very business oriented people in organized crime, right? So, but by not having, by having a insider's club that denies basic competitive, like which works as a cartel, which denies basic competitive principles and extends to other, you know, possible competitors and a chance at the market, right? Then you're going to just create organized crime. So the collapse of things, and why we say this is because the collapse of things in Ukraine has been a very sad tale of what would have happened to Russia if their deep state, their true deep state, like their deepest hermeticized inside deep state, was not dedicated towards national sovereignty. Ukraine, the security agency of Ukraine, failed it. The political class and what politicians, you know, that's a different type of human being is like from a politician and a sovereign intelligence organization that your primary job when it comes to the countries under assault are questions of continuation of governance. Without that, you can't charge or investigate. Without that group, you cannot charge or investigate a senator or any elected official or judge of being under foreign influence. And then the country can be taken over by outside forces from the inside through your own political class. And that's what happened in Ukraine. Their intelligence organization, now it's a mockery. The SBU, it's a joke. It's just run directly from the Cabal Network out of Poland, Langley, whatever. And as a mockery to history and to spite the world, but also to spite them, they make them be Nazis, because that'll work the best against Russians. But also, in the event that they're losing and need to annihilate the population of Ukraine, then the West will start to say, "Oh, well, I guess they were Nazis, in fact, so we shouldn't mourn the losses of this war on the Ukrainian side now that the Russians have won." I mean, they'll do any number of things. They'll play any number of games if they think they have an angle, if it'll give them an angle to get into Ukraine, or if it'll give them an angle to build their power in Poland or Estonia even more, or to overthrow Orban, right? So in Hungary, they can play the Ukraine game any number of ways. So that doesn't look like they're losing. It's like, oh, well, you know, we're actually winning. They'll backfill a new narrative moving forward, right? But you can't backfill a narrative on real existing assets, on real existing property, on real existing, on gold, on food, things, you know, minerals like mines, right? Factories, distilling plants, chemical production. If you don't have those, and all you have is like a mythology of numbers on a screen and using media magic to create and deflate, you know, sensational stories about companies to make them sink or whatever, and the hedge fund game behind that as well. You can't have a economy based on fiction, right? But they did. They went totally postmodern. I'm not even suggesting there was another way. That's, you know what I mean? I mean, people would make a good argument to me that it could have been, and I would listen and, you know, probably agree with much of what they had to say. I'm just not in the, you know, I'm not in the game of what could have been or would have been. Ukraine is a disaster now, and it has been for years. So the information war coming out of Ukraine are meant to increase, to drive up the stakes for the Russians. These provocations, these ISIS-like mutilations and stuff of captured soldiers that you've seen is precisely made to use the Western establishment press afterwards to say that Russian atrocities were probable because look at all this evidence that they were going after Nazis. Ba-dum-bum. That's one possible contingency of numerous ones, you know. Just this is all the different ways that these things can be played. But what you can't play is the actual ownership of a specific resource or territory, which is, you know, in this complex world is a national state question at the geopolitical level. And then it's a domestic economic question internally, how you use private property or, you know, nationalized concerns and how you balance those towards the most efficient outcome. But all of these should be made sort of within the premise of national sovereignty, right? So that if you privatize things, they're not owned by foreign countries. So those are two different things. Foreign ownership and private ownership can't be this the same thing. You would have to make it be like you have to be of this country, but then also not be a dual citizen of some other magical country where magical things happen, you see? Now, I'm going to, in the area that I say I'm preparing my final notes, put your questions. We'll take a minute. You know what? I'll just make a new, strike that. I'm just going to make a new questions. I'm going to take just like 4 or 5 questions. And maybe 3. And but don't be shy. And then we'll wrap this up. But just focusing on, you know, how the Great Reset's failing and the timing of things, how things have to be timed a certain way. That was really our emphasis. And I'll be back in about a minute.
All right, I'm back. So I have some good questions from you. But they're all on point. They're all about the Great Reset. Okay, you can't think about the power of the cabal, okay, through a Marxist lens in the vulgar sense of they control all, like the ruling class controls all the wealth and power. Okay. Like you, the citizens, like all of you, the people in the middle class and the working class, small business owners, entrepreneurs, builders, contractors, plumbers, engineers, et cetera, programmers, sky's the limit. That is the fact that you have skills and all that. That is the potential value in the society. Everything else is an inanimate structure whose, you know, cost of building has, a lot of it has already been, you know, amortized out of existence. But the new stuff, they're running out of being able to invest into new things because new technologies have, you know, the general tendency over time is a disinflationary effect. So it also conforms to the overall law of diminishing returns. And it, when you use the whole concept of technology itself as the, as meaning all of it, right? Like all of the machines and industry and, you know, new labor saving technologies, you know, once you've under some kind of price fixing or competitive monopolistic between big vectors, kind of pseudo competition that takes place, once you've eaten through or, you know, earned back through the research and implement, you know, development and implementation of that labor saving technology, then you can even like bring your price justifiably lower than that. Okay. But if you never had to pay back the money of that that had gone into the implementation anyway, then you could start introducing, like if that was a subsidy, right, from the government, then you can start implementing the disinflationary price schemes like right away, right? Because you wouldn't have to, you would not have a problem with the shareholders with that, right? So you can see, therefore, how the Great Reset is not coming together, because for all those reasons. But I think the big, you know, if you're looking for sort of like a very big, you know, like what proves what their motive, what, how it was going to work out, and it didn't work out, is the resistance to the immediate release of the vaccine, right? The resistance against that and having to fight Big Pharma and to fight the FDA, because the truth, right, was that this proven unsafe gene therapy that was never going to be altered or improved or made more safe over time, if it didn't have to be. We know how that works in normal, that's not a conspiracy theory, that's how normal works in you know, Big Pharma, right? When they release a new drug and then there's like the lawsuits that build up around. Okay, and they release it without those liabilities, like most of those liabilities, much more difficult to make the claim for this, calling it a vaccine for a pandemic, right? So that would have justified the lockdowns that never ended. And that's why we talk about that number of that, you know, 25, 30,000 people die in the US per 1% increase of unemployment, right? But the billions of lives that were saved because the vaccine that was already tested and researched on prisoners and people in India and people in Africa, like gene therapy like that, they've been testing it like through secret operations that run through the front of the World Health Organization's, you know, vaccination campaign in sub-Saharan Africa and parts of India. Well, I think they got in trouble in India. But I mean, yeah, a lot of people they've killed with these experimental things that they do, but they kind of know kind of how it works, at least like in certain, you know, racial groups, you know, in general as this thing, and can extrapolate and some differences on just kind of how it would have worked. But these gene therapies have been around and experimented on people in the third world, fourth world for quite some time. So it's not, it wasn't like, oh, if they had researched it more, then it'd be less adverse effects. Like, this is like the state of the technology right now. This is just the state of the technology, right? So there may be some promise of that technology in the future in some way, but if the intentions, if the power structures around those big, you know, those companies are working towards sort of like more like biological weapons, then that's a catastrophe. It's a catastrophe. It's a human catastrophe. So the technology by itself doesn't save things or mess things up. And, you know, is what's going on with the people is the fundamental question. Just like guns, you know, guns don't kill people. People kill people. And technology works the same way. Everything is like a tool. Everything has a dual. Everything's like a dual use technology, right? Everything. The Great Reset intended, we know from the COVID-19, The Great Reset book, that book was written at the, like they released it. I mean, it was pre-written, obviously, like you released the book so quickly, right when the thing happened, right? And when you have to read it, but unfortunately, like there are people that put out fake excerpts from that book that are actually from some other book. The Great Reset book just doesn't read that way. It's just not written that way. It's not written like a negative thing. It's all written all like, you know, responsibly. It's very socially conscious and responsible the way that it's written. It doesn't say like, and now we shall kill 3 billion people as the worthless eaters. Like, that's a fake quote. It's terrible that that's going on, because it disempowers people from learning how power actually uses language to communicate bad ideas through things that sound nice, not through things that sound evil. It's this really bad, like John Birch Society type of conservative propaganda that became popular in, parts of America that were anti-intellectual. And then they were able, because people didn't understand those ideas, then they could just connect things that weren't connectable. You know what I mean? Like, Nazism and communism are very different. You could be against both of them, but you would be wrong to call them the same or even similar. They just function on very different levels, you know? They're not like two plants in the same garden or something like that. And that's why in a lot of conservative punditry, they talk about like the Great Reset and stuff. It's like, oh, this communism is happening. And it's like, if you said that a single corporation that controlled everything is a private entity, is the same thing as a like communist party dictatorship and a one party state controlling everything, at some level, it's absolutely correct. But because Nazism and fascism is the model, it actually says that it should be privatized, kind of like monopoly corporation or syndicate using private property that actually has the control of in the society, then like in the functions of fascism and Nazism, then it's more accurate to call the Great Reset agenda kind of like Nazi-ish or fascistic or something like that, okay? Just because they use themes of like green and ecological concerns and human rights and social justice, like the language of fascism and Nazism also contains a lot of social democratic references to these same things. The rights of labor, they use a lot of anti-capitalist language in the explicit ideologies in fascism and Nazism. They use explicit and overt anti-capitalist language. And, Hitler like went a little easier on that stuff later in time in terms of the anti-capitalist rhetoric, but it was a huge part of the discursive framework of both Nazism and fascism to have an anti-capitalist and social justice kind of, you know, jargon. But the thing, the difference to understand is that while like communism might be like the some kind of tragic folly of good intentions, right, that just are just based on unworkable ideas, right, that are naively attempted by idealistic and humanistically oriented revolutionaries, that just kind of becomes this tragic tale where the thing like works against its, you know, overt, you know, thinking, like its overt intentions may have been like in some way noble if you limit it, if you limit or redefine certain concepts a certain way, right? But they weren't using that cynically to arrive at a problematic outcome. Whereas like in Nazism, they were kind of like looking at what happened with communism, but they were like, okay, so how we as the ruling class can kind of like get a party state together, but not actually lose power to Bolsheviks. So I'm not proposing that Bolsheviks did anything better or worse. I'm just saying how they saw it. So National Socialism was like how the ruling class that didn't want to lose power to Bolsheviks was like, okay, but let's take like what we think works with like how they do power, but through the lens of how in our paradigm, you know, the themes that still make sense to us. So that's why you have like those more traditional and conservative, both heuristic and, you know, symbolic reference in the Nazi state to certain aspects of the older, you know, German orders in the past was a, you know, an expression of the conservative aspects of Nazism. And so they kind of like in the public relations campaign were able to kind of like bring together people that had been socialists, but maybe kind of more patriotic socialists than the communists were, but you know, in the past maybe had even voted for the communists, and got a lot of those people to like become Nazis and vote for the Nazis, right, at the level of politics, right? But the communists were around, you know, for the communists were around for like 5 or 10 years before there was really like a noticeable Nazi fascist thing. And that was a new thing that popped up. But the like the Marxist thing that had been behind the communist thing had been going on since the end of the 19th century. And for that whole period, you kind of have like the kind of Bismarck position of viewing it as a contest between like the traditional German society against the socialists. And then you had like Bismarck's anti-socialist legislation, but which included the creation or increase in authority and finance for a welfare state, knowing that if you did things like UBI or have like a welfare state, right, because Andrew Yang references Bismarck in a number of his talks, and it just goes right over the heads of the people interviewing him because they're fucking mongoloids, right? But Andrew Yang is not a mongoloid, you know. And but you know, they just pretend as if this we can't look at these things. They pretend like we're not going to figure these things out. Andrew Yang understands Bismarck. And the anti-socialist laws included creating things of like that had a welfare state nature. But still, in that time period, it was understood that way. Fascism comes about more when you have kind of like a managerial class of people, experts like in Bernaysian marketing and propaganda, and have maybe some access to some labor leaders, but also a lot of military and old traditional powers. And you get access to a newspaper and just kind of how you want to emulate what this is going to be in Germany. You know, fascism, Nazism in Germany is like, rather than having this conflict between the socialists and the traditionalists that kind of like proposed this third thing that was like the party of the socialists, the traditional socialists, or something like that, like bizarre, right? But it was simultaneously a party state, but anti-communist. And it actually preserved the power of the corporations, whereas where the actual communists took power, the first thing they did was smash like those corporations and stuff that were running the country. And now you're free to evaluate however those societies turned out, or if it was the same in the end or worse. However, that's another discussion. We're only, again, you know, and I reiterate, because you have to like walk through the shoes of these things to understand them. Like the communists are like idealists at the very level of even the leadership at the top. Whereas Nazis use idealism cynically at the top, knowing that they're going to operationalize this kind of more like traditional military, you know, Kshatriya sort of Hindu Vedic structure of class society on castes and stuff. And the socialism part is just like, because the whole thing will be kind of orchestrated so that it works that way in a stable way. Not that it's like the same as the Marxist socialists, you see, just a very overused word in Europe by this time. Even 100 years ago, the word was overused. It was just like saying, like, the socialist was just like saying a Democrat or something, or a liberal in the lowercase, you know, L's and D's of the sense of the word, you see. And today it also means nothing. Like, the socialists in Romania, like, mean nothing related to the socialists in France, and they don't even have the same opinions about things, and none of them are really particularly left-wing per se. That's the thing. Just, these are all vestigial. You know, but the biggest difference with the Nazi state and the Azov, or the Nazification of Ukraine, Azov just being like one fraction of a tenth of a permutation of the Nazi aspects of Ukraine. It's a confusion to confuse the Nazi battalions as being that part of the Ukrainian society that needs to be denazified. That's only the military part of it. There's a legal, there's a judicial, there's a legislative, and at the level of like police chiefs and all of these like towns and villages are all Nazis. You don't need, I mean, you know, what's the population percentage of the workforce of like the public sector, you see? And you just have to privilege the Nazis in that over the non, and then also have similar social pressure on private institutions and, you know, maybe private universities, but definitely over the public ones. Denazification is a whole other process. So, they got into this, they thought it was going to go a certain way earlier on. They couldn't get Russia and Ukraine involved in a war against each other in 2014. It was brilliant to come up with the LPR and DPR and use the primary strategy of breaking over the pro-Russian elements of the Ukrainian army early on. They coordinated with generals at that stage. All of them defected, or, you know, went into protective, you know, custody ever since. Who led the military battalions over into DPR and LPR that became the units of the LPR and DPR. And there's very little evidence of Russian equipment in the large sense of heavy arms or whatever going into Donetsk and Lugansk. This was all like stuff like from that you could buy, that you could buy, and you could get, and you could, you know, just like orchestrated defections and stuff. There's just like all kinds of interesting things going on at this time 8 years ago. So I'm not surprised to see weapons sold in the field now. Looking at your questions. Did I have a falling out with Mark Sloboda? You know what's funny? I never had a chance to be Mark Sloboda's friend. He seemed to just be antagonistic to my existence before I even, you know, had a possibility to interact with him or have a thing, you know, any issue with him. But he seemed not to like my existence. And, but anyway, it nevertheless, as things evolved to be, it turned out that he was like wrong, like 80% of the time or something like that. Like anything that Mark Sloboda said was going to happen was kind of like the opposite of the thing that would end up happening. So it just makes you like wonder. I didn't have it, but I never know. The guy's never wronged me. He's never stolen money from me, or you know what I mean. Mark Sloboda is not a thief. Okay, don't get me wrong, at all. You know, there's nothing wrong with Mark Sloboda's morality. He, from what I understand, he's a man of his word and all these things. Okay, there's no, you know, moral defect with Mark Sloboda that I can determine. Okay, but in the And, you know, who am I to judge, right? You know what I mean? Like, so, but from what I can determine, he did attempt to be hired by the Texas-based private intelligence company that works alongside the CIA. And he applied, that came out in WikiLeaks, that Mark Sloboda, you know, had tried to throw in his weight with Stratfor private intelligence out of Texas, I believe. So yeah, people think that's just weird, you know, when that kind of stuff comes out. I guess it raises suspicions. But like that's a fact that he did that, but that doesn't mean he's like a bad guy. Maybe he was trying to like infiltrate and then report back to the Russians and stuff. Who knows? Like, you know, you never know, you know, people, God bless them. You just don't know. So, but I don't know if he would like, you don't know if he was doing a script or something. Like he could have been, I mean, he's a smart guy. So to be wrong, like 80% of the time, like maybe his role on the show was to give something to, you know, Peter Lavelle to like argue against or something. You know what I mean? Like maybe his job was to be the fall guy or something like that on the show. I don't know. But, you know, he did seem to have a inflated sense of NATO's power. And he always thought that like everything that Russia was doing when it's just doing like Russian diplomacy, like in the way that we explain in such elaborate detail on the show, he seems to think he kind of views through this like Orientalist lens, like that the Russians are too like sluggish or slow or forgiving or permissive or whatever, you know. So now, I'm looking at your questions. That's with this quiet little, sorry, I should have said, I'm looking at your questions now. Yeah, turning the page. Let's see. What do I think about Bitcoin? It's possible right now to make real money on Bitcoin, you know, and I think that there will be value in Bitcoin that's relatively stable. Can only by definition go up in value, I think, but when states totally fail, okay, they can get access to your password and take your identity, and you know, that's like when states totally fail, like it's very hard to hold on to assets in general, like beyond what you can hold and somehow fight. You know what, how? So I look at it through that lens. So I don't think that there's anything like structurally or inherently problematic with Bitcoin. And it makes sense also for people to like get in and out of it. To get in, this is just my opinion, you know what I mean? I'm not giving like financial advice. I'm just saying like what I think, you know, just one man's opinion, right? This is not like a consultation or something. What I think is that Bitcoin is the stability of Bitcoin is relative to the stability of the society, but it can move inversely at times depending on the way that different directions that it destabilizes. But at a certain level of destabilization, you can be, you know, like, you know, rubber hose hacking. Like you can be hacked by people in real life that beat you with a rubber hose and get into your, you know, digital currencies and transfer them to themselves, right? So there's limits to everything. Okay, let's see, turning the page. What's the point of NATO dragging Finland and Sweden into their organizations? If anything, it just hurts economies of Sweden and Finland. Yeah, they have a lot of production plants. Well, the thing is that the EU gains the pressures on those countries. See, they try to maintain independence in general over all these different ways from the EU and stuff, and especially from NATO. And it's very difficult. But it's not invisible to people, the various problems that come with it. But the best way to understand the NATO dragging in Finland and Sweden all of a sudden, the effect that you experience from that is the intended effect. What they want, it's obviously confusing if you understand the question you ask can be one from a position of like bewilderment or like what's the point of it, right? Like as you say, what's the point? Sort of like, you know, it's a little bit surprising almost, right? Because it's like, what's the point? It doesn't really confer any strategic advantage because either of those countries could have decided to contribute money to NATO or weapons to NATO in, you know, wars, or to even fight as countries in a war that NATO's in without being a member of NATO. There's like nothing in there. If you're not in NATO, that doesn't like trigger something in your laws in your own country that you can't join a war that NATO's in on NATO's side. This focus on NATO is almost absurd. It's like the concept of NATO is a kind of like, it works on another level. But for people who've been on the inside of it, they even told their Atlantic Council and NATO, you know, colleagues and, you know, counterparts, like, man, like I like I used to be worried about NATO when I was a kid, like these Russians that attended some meetings. This was like talked about by the in the video that I shared earlier, where the people creating the American narrative on the conflict in Ukraine are getting their talking points from. Scroll up, you'll find it. And they are being pressured to make a very big potential commitment that has negative economic ramifications for them. They're going to see a poor access to markets in Russia. As you mentioned, these countries have a lot of production plants in Russia. You give the example of Fazer, Valio, and that Russia is around 20% market share for those companies. So yes, you know, your sentiment is great. Fine, F the economics, right? It's just going to increase tensions on the border. Why would Finland do that? Still bamboozled by that. Yeah, no, it's absolutely, you know, mind-bending, but it's this is just the corruption in these countries at that level. But they're not, it's the actual thing that's happening is that even though these are happening at the same time that that Russia is militarily involved in an invasion of some kind of Ukraine, right? It doesn't mean that that they're doing this means that NATO is getting stronger. It means that they felt it was critical at this time that they perceived that others would perceive them as actually weaker. So they needed this flex in order to like telegraph to the world that actually they were getting stronger by having like countries join that would be allowed to join with very, very minimal requirements on their own, you know, force status. Whereas, like, the hatred for Soviet people, including Ukrainians, by the West is so immense. They just view those Ukrainians that are like the Nazi ones, like the liberal establishment in the West uses them, like the Trudeau establishment uses them in Canada, you see, like the establishment behind Trudeau. They can be like liberals over here and back Nazism over there. It's not the same thing as German Nazism. And yet they it's like a joke to them that these Ukrainians have German ideology of German supremacism and anti-Slavishness when they themselves are the Slavs. You know, those genetic weapons that they were allowing to be, this is like the symbolism of it, like wrapped up in the reality, like those genetic weapons that Ukrainians authorities were allowing the cabal to have, like those biological weapons plants in Ukraine that were developing, the ones that were like, they were the one company had been taking in gene samples from the population, like of Ukrainians and Russians. Right. Because it's like not a lot of difference. And normal mainstream news has been reporting for a long time that the next wars would be biological wars where the pathogens were designed to target people like of different, like maybe it was haplogroups or other gene markers. We talked about this before. A lot of things are on the line. So just one man's opinion, you know, I think that my sense of it is that the markers that I've identified as being the ones important to notate in terms of the steps of the Great Reset have not been implemented you know, on time or of effect or of the, you know, consequence that has increased their power in the way that they needed to. So they're like falling much shorter of their, they've done things, you know, you have to understand they've done things, but the order of magnitude of effectiveness is like bizarrely bad. You know, it's strange how bad the outcome has been for them. And then now to be losing in a war in Ukraine, so they can pretend that this was the war that they wanted, because it represents a civil war inside of Russia, inside of the Soviet Union, rather, and among different types of Russian peoples, perhaps. The fact that it's happening now, and that the Russian side is like going to be the clear winner, or is the clear winner, is just this thing has to play out over time. But the end is all but certain on that end of things, in terms of their strategic objectives. So, you know, we'll see what happens. But I thought it would be good to continue to show the relationship between the Great Reset and the conflict in Ukraine in general. I think it's an important thing to understand, because the reset can't be done the way they want if they can't control much of the global economy. And despite the fact that they will go on into these shows and stuff and these lectures, and they'll talk about investment in China, when they're saying, like, when they talk about the importance of the investment in China, okay, they're not saying that they have the levels and types of access to Chinese markets that they want. They're actually saying this is a language where they say, like, this is access to markets that we want and don't have. That's why we keep saying that, you know, emerging markets in China have a particular interest, and they're investing their resources into getting access to Chinese market share. And they do have some, but not enough to determine policies. I'm not saying influence, but to determine policies in China. You know, they don't have that level. The cabal doesn't have that level of power. That's not to say that China is, you know, like doing great things or not. I'm just talking about the real existing, you know, balance of power and stuff in the world, right? Let me look at your next questions. But that's as much as, like, China is useful as a subject for me right now. Okay, let's see. Turning the page. Question is with Bitcoin, how can states get your password if you are holding your own non-custodial wallet and private keys? Because they can take you into custody and then make you just log in as you there, and then make you transfer, like, your money to their account or something. You know what I mean? Just like a basic rubber hose hack. Like, the actual, it's basically the actual person being kidnapped or held hostage is what I mean by not 100%. Like, I see that Bitcoin is stable, that there's ways to make money in Bitcoin right now, and that requires buying it right now, you know, in my opinion, in one man's opinion. But, like, so don't misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm just saying long term, if there's like a big if that's why I said I tied it to the stability of society. And even though there's some aspects of it that work contra direction to stability, like value can go up as stability, you know, goes down in some instances under some conditions, and maybe as a general trend at times. But in terms of ultimately what happens, like when societies totally break down, is they can rubber hose hack, meaning that they can like come in and, you know, physically like have a gun to your head to get into your stuff. And, you know, whether they succeed or not, you probably don't live, right? But maybe you live if they succeed, probably. I think it's hard. You can have it be that certain amounts of transfers can't be transferred unless another thing, but then you have a hostage situation or they go rubber hose the other parties that are parts of the process. I mean, states break down. I mean, they're going to control banks and control all kinds of things, you know. If society totally breaks down when you have like warlordism, then like, you know, just they can just think about like in Mariupol, like people getting like picked up and, you know, they're being shook down for their, you know, bank account numbers to get, you know, things or whatever. So, yeah, just think about it in those terms. So someone's pointing out that Swedes, people voted for no NATO in the past. Now the majority wants to join according to the government. Hey, you know, it's just their own. They just need. I'll just say. It would be a total surprise to me if the present, you know, Russian doctrines and potential stratagems for dealing with a war in Europe broadly, there's no way that they would have thought that Finland and Sweden would be neutral in a military way, correct? So, that's just the, you know, the nature of the animal. It would be extraordinarily bizarre to me, you know, if Russians didn't have already worked out in their, you know, scenarios that in probably all the scenarios, like, Sweden and Finland are, you know, part of, you know, a NATO alliance, because you don't have to, I mean, part of NATO's alliance doesn't have to see, like, if it's a NATO war and then the NATO builds an alliance of, you know, the, what is it, like, alliance of the willing or whatever, you know, you can still join NATO's war, you know, and just like not seeing the basic, because all the people in power have like names and they like attend meetings and they're known who kind of operates them and, you know, whatnot. So when these people do that and they're the ones running the state, then you can tell that if the country goes to war, like, you know, or if there's a war at that time, then that state's going to join the war on the side of, you know, NATO. Like, that's not, you don't need to be a part of NATO to join a war on the side of NATO. That's why it's just kind of like a bizarre, people have a bizarre take on the, you know, on the conflict. It's not wrong, but it's just a, you know, focus of it, of the NATO part of it is like, it's what NATO means, like what it signifies is a large problem for Russia, but that's what it signifies, you know. There are increased requirements often for NATO countries, however, that in NATO, you may have to like host or have certain weapon systems, and having those there, you know, then means that your country and potentially just like your civilians are then like the target of these things, you see, and that becomes a bigger problem, right? When your population is the target of surface to surface missiles that are supposed to take out your systems. And by having more of those systems there, there's more effort and more stuff gets shot at you. There's more of a chance that you have to actually send in boots on the ground to neutralize those, you know, artillery at a certain point, right? So it's like now your country's being invaded. But all of that would have been part of Russian thinking for some time. So that's why it does, it's just not. But yeah, I think this was a very good episode where I'm going to put it up on the drive. I'm going to, private message me, not the guy selling you or telling you to buy things from India, who's like my fake account. My account looks different. So it doesn't look like the image of the logo of the channel. That's not the avatar that I have for my personal account. So, but contact me through there if you want to support this channel or my work, rather. And not this channel, to have access to these recordings. All right, that's it for me. Take care. Bye-bye.